we progress in the talk. The first picture here refers to two things, WebEd and filters, which I have not defined, but maybe I'll tell you where the picture comes from. I started to work on some of these things here, which are related to representations of Kunze algebras, among other things, and then I somehow an early experience from my early childhood was seeing pictures like the one in the top slide here. My dad is a signal processing engineer. He built some, you know, the filters that are used for processing speech as it's transmitted in the early days over long cables. And it turns out that dividing a signal up in frequency bands was one of the early things, going back also to way Norbert Wiener thought of the time series, filtering time series by taking a weighted average over the discrete time points in backwards in time. And then you see these arrows up and down. I'll explain them. The engineers call them downsampling and upsampling. The subdivision is called the analysis of the signal, and putting it back together and adding it up is the output, and that's called synthesis of the filter. Now, what turns out, if you look at this picture here, then you see that there's a bunch of operators that get put together in a sum and then added up, and out comes the same thing. So that means you're looking at a bunch of operators that add up to the identity. And you think of whether you might have seen that before. Here's one. And so that was, with hindsight, I realized that there must be a relation between this picture that I probably saw it first time before I could read, you know, like kindergarten, around that time. And then with a long delay of 50 years or so, maybe less, I try to make a connection between this, and of course it sounds completely crazy. But then I remembered another thing I took a closer look at the signal processing literature, and I read that it's very important that there's no interference between frequency bands, and they may even have used the word orthogonal. Well, then you look at these bands here, and those would be the ranges of isometries, and we know in the Kunze relation the ranges of the isometries are supposed to be orthogonal. So then I became even more suspicious that there was a relation between them. And indeed there is. And in fact, you could argue that the engineers discovered very important class of representations of the Kunze algebra before Kunze probably was born. And they not only found them, but they actually found the representation, because they wouldn't care about the Kunze algebra or anything with Hilbert space. But they need some very definite numbers, because they need to process speech signals here. And turns out that this way of dividing signals up applies to images as well, the way they're done in a digital camera now. And it's the same thing here, that there should not be an interference between the frequency bands, and that it should preserve the energy, and the energy comes from a quadratic expression, which we use in Hilbert space theory as a norm squared, and the orthogonality is, of course, the inner product. And so, lo and behold, you see this thing coming in. So not to keep you in suspense, I'll just mention that you could think of the numbers that the engineers are using as Fourier series like this, and they're the numbers, and these numbers are called filter coefficients. And then you wonder about the operators, and the operators are the kind of operators that some have been mentioned today here. You take a power of the complex variable z here, and you multiply it by a function, so you'd say that this is a composition operator modified with a multiplication operator in the language we now use. And that turns out to be the operators on the right-hand side. And it turns out that the substitution here is the one that the engineers would call upsampling. That's not surprising, because if you replace z to a power by z to the n, then you just get multiples of this fixed n here. And so that means you take a time series, and you take exactly the numbers in the series, but you then interspace zeros between them. And so that's what upsampling is, and downsampling is the adjoint of that, and that corresponds to killing off everything that's not divisible by whatever your number n is here. And so that means that if you just think of these operators here, then you have what the engineers are looking for, and the engineers are looking for the secret numbers here. And in the beginning, there were patterns for every one of these numbers. But it turns out these secret numbers are also the numbers that answer questions in wavelet theory. So that was the top part of the picture. And then the middle part of the picture is about functions from the circle in the complex plane into the unitary n by n matrices. And so a function like that is an element in a group. And since the circle goes around, the image goes around in the group, so it's called a loop. And the group of all these maps is called a loop group, and it's obviously infinite dimensional. And it turns out that the representations we're studying here can be indexed by points in the loop group, and that's why that's item number two in the discussion. And item number three is representations, and you can see from this Fourier series here that the representations should act on functions on the circle. I call it T for the one torus, because the two torus is just T cross T, and so that's that. And so we also know there's a close connection between endomorphisms and representations. I'll mention that in a moment. But so those are the three characters in the play today. And I've been teaching some of this in a graduate class with a mix of students from engineering and math. And so this is a picture from this book that I wrote based on the course. And so this is a little more fancy. Of this version here I only have two frequency bands. And I put in the engineering linguist, because half of the students were from engineering. And if I didn't explain things in their language, they would probably have dropped the class. But I managed to make some translation here. And another thing that's very helpful is to think of the S operators that I already mentioned here. Think of them both in the multiplicative version, so that means a complex Z on the circle, or in the additive version, which is addition modulo 1, because you can take the circumference of the circle and normalize it to be 1. So that means that these two are the same thing, just written in slightly different language. And I think that's all I need from that slide. And but just because I'm going to mention these concepts here a lot, I'll go through just a little dictionary of the discrete time variable and the corresponding Fourier series. And so again, the engineers think of time series as just sequences indexed by the integers from minus infinity to plus infinity. And if you make the terms in the sequence into Fourier coefficients, you get a Fourier series. And in engineering language, they call it a frequency response function. It's just because it's a function. And the Z variable is called the frequency variable because it's the continuous frequency that's dual to the discrete time. But in the language of mathematics, it's that the dual of the integers is the circle group. And then, of course, the way Norbert Wiener thought of filters is Cauchy product. And so if you think of your time series here as the time variable, then the time variable n is translated back by k, and then the a numbers are the weight coefficients. But in mathematical language, of course, it's the Cauchy product, and the engineers like it because it becomes a multiplication. So you just do algebra and multiplication operators. And time shift by one variable, by one unit in the time variable becomes multiplication by z, and the adjoint is the one in the other direction, so that's complex conjugate. And now we get to the up and down arrows in this picture here, and that's very, very simple, but the engineers would think about the upsampling as putting in the terms in the series at every place that's divisible by the number of bands, so that's capital N, and put in zero on the other, and the adjoint of that is the sub, so in the other side here becomes just the substitution here, and the adjoint of that is an average over the nth roots. And the left hand column here, that's the process that's applied to the time series, and it says that every time that's not divisible by n is the number for that time is just killed, so that's why it's called downsampling. So this is isometric because you don't lose anything, and this is co-isometric, and that's all there is to it. And then you combine them together here, and because I want to be consistent with normalization, I have to put in a square root n here, and you'll see later why I want to be careful with normalization. And it's just the two operators put together here. And those are then the operators that generate these particular classes of representations of the Kunz algebra. That's all there is to it. It's very, very simple. And I just leave that. No, maybe I'll take one or two wavelets and one or two things that you do with this process here. I'd like to take the simplest case of them all, and that's the Haar wavelet. That's now 100 years old, and it turns out that the subject of wavelets really started 70 years after Haar discovered the first one, and the missing ingredient was exactly the stuff that the engineers really had known for a long time, but making the connection between computing in wavelets on the one side and using these tools from engineering that had been invented for a totally different purpose, that was really what offered a lot of techniques for computing with wavelet coefficients, because these techniques from engineering just turns the issue of computing wavelet coefficients into a matrix question with very, very easy to compute matrices. But the simplest of them all is, of course, the Haar wavelet, and there they are, the constant function in the unit interval, value 1, and the zigzag version of it, the unit interval divided in two, and then being one on the first half and minus one in the second half. By the way, they're always called phi and psi, and in the literature they're also called phi and mother function, but the father function is not important. You can forget it for the moment, at least. The wavelet is supposed to be an orthonormal basis in L2 of the real line, and it's supposed to come from a single function by allowing only two things, scaling by powers of a fixed number or a fixed matrix, and translating by points on a lattice. The simplest of all your lattices would be the integers as a subset, a subgroup of the real line. So that's supposed to give you an orthonormal basis, and it's quite easy to see it. Set j equal to 0, then you translate the zigzag function by unit amounts, so they would obviously be orthogonal. But if you scale by j, then you just this is a translation by a dyadic fraction, which is adjusted just to the spacing from psi, so they would also be orthogonal. So the only issue is if they're orthogonal, if you have different values of j. But in that case, the larger power of 2 would move faster, so there'd be a zigzag. There would be a small zigzag inside a big zigzag, and you multiply them together, and you'll get a plus that cancels a minus. So they'll also be orthogonal. Then you take linear span, and you've got all the step function, and you know that they they're dense in L2 of the real line, and there's the proof that this is an orthonormal basis. And but that's sort of a hand-waving proof, and what the other techniques are doing is they give you a way of making that systematic. But it also shows you that there's an issue about computing with these things here that applies whenever you have a single transformation, such as a scaling, and repeat it over and over. And in a sense, that happens also when you do pictures in the complex plane by substituting a rational function into itself and repeating and taking the limit, and you get your Julia sets, and analysis on Julia sets can be done by much the same way. And this would be mentioned in the next talk by my collaborator Doran Dutkai, and a lot of what I do in this talk here is also joint work with the next speaker, Doran Dutkai, and so he'll get into more of the use of these techniques for substitution of a rational map in the complex plane. Here's a definition of the Julia set. The Julia set is the complement to the largest open set, so that the iterated substitutions form a normal family. And again, if you have continuous functions on the Julia set, you can make a substitution operator. You can take branches of the inverse of the rational map, and you can find a measure on the Julia set which just subdivides the Julia set in n pieces, and you continue subdividing, and you get an L2 analysis on L2 of this measure. The existence of these measures for Julia sets were found in 1965 by Swedish mathematician Brolin, but the use of orthogonal computational devices based on these things. I think that I've not seen that other places than in my work with Doran Dutkai. So that was one more thing. So I just want to say that the tools that we study here. I guess I'll just drop both of them. Have uses outside just this wavelet, the particular wavelet application that I mentioned here. All right. So one more thing. I said that you could scale in D dimension. You could scale by a matrix. So you take a D by D matrix over the integers, and to generalize the fact that the number 2 is bigger than 1, we demand that all the eigenvalues of the matrix are bigger than 1. And then we want to see what it means for a function in L2 to give a wavelet by the same procedure as we did for the Haar wavelet here. And what it would mean is that when you translate by the integer lattice in D dimension, and if you scale by integer powers of the matrix, so if J gets large, then it's a high-frequency function. If J gets small, it moves very slowly. And you want then to get an orthonormal basis here indexed by these two things, J and K. And so what you're actually looking at is you're looking at the so-called AX plus B group discretized, and you're looking at a subset of the AX plus B group, not a subgroup, a subset. Turns out that the variation of J and K corresponds to a subset of a famous AX plus B group. And so you have a unitary representation in the sense of Mackey of that group, but it's a discrete version of it. And then you want to find a single vector in L2 of RD, so that if you apply the unitary maps to it, the result is one ring, in the sense that all the vectors are orthogonal as you vary the pair J and K. So that's what a wavelet is. And then in addition to that, you demand that it'll be an ONB. And that's what a wavelet is. And it's kind of a miracle that there are any at all. And one way to do it is using these engineering techniques that I mentioned already now. But I want to mention one more technique. Now, the engineering techniques are very good for wavelets that are compact support in the X-verb, that's sometimes called time localized. And now I'm mentioning another one when it's localized in the Fourier transform verb. And so we Fourier transform the formula from above, and we're careful with the, when we move from one side in the Fourier duality to the other, we have to pay with a transpose of the matrix. And so you get this one here. And so you say, how in the world are we going to find any solution to this at all? Now, for reasons that I don't quite know, but Larson was probably the first to find them of the simplest kind, where the psi hat is the indicator function of a subset of RD. So you want that subset to be measurable. And if you write down what it requires to have this be a wavelet, you discover that what is required for that is that the set E in the indicator function here, so that necessary and sufficient is that it has two properties, that E should tile RD by multiplication, matrix multiplications with all integer powers, and it should tile RD by all possible translations with points in the integer lattice. So you move E around by translations with the integer lattice, and it's going to fill out all of RD without any gaps, without any overlap. Same with the multiplicative action, and so then it kind of became a popular game to write down such interesting wavelet sets, and it's still a popular game. By the way, the wavelet representation is the unitary representation of this discrete version of the X plus B group. It happens to be a type 2 group, and the if you direct integral decompose that. Then the direct integrals are supported by sets E with this property here, forgetting the second property. Amusing thing, obviously, there's, since it's in the measurable category, there's an infinite set of possibilities for that. You can have two disjoint sets still supporting the same unitary representation in its direct integral, since other people mentioned direct integrals, I thought I'd just mention that as well here. let's see, what's a good place to start? I mentioned the example with the iteration of a rational function in the complex plane, and for later purposes, I hope I get to cover it. If not, Doyen Dutkai will. We need a conditional expectation onto the range of the first substitution, and then you can continue the substitutions here. And then because several people mentioned Hilbert modules. Obviously, this here is a baby version of a Hilbert module, and I'm able now, with this definition of a Hilbert module, I'm able to give you a necessary and sufficient condition for these MI functions to define a representation of the Kunz algebra, and I can give it in the language of Hilbert modules, a necessary and sufficient condition for the M functions here. To give us a representation of the Kunz algebra is that they form an ONB in this Hilbert module here. So in a sense, the filters that the engineers have constructed now for 60 years, they're actually solutions to what is an ONB in a particular Hilbert module. But if you turn to other Hilbert modules other than the ones from Wedel theory, for example, from iterating a rational function of a complex variable, they're not nice ONBs in this particular Hilbert module. So an interesting problem for students is, or anyone else, is to imitate the techniques that work so well for these other affine systems. They're kind of linear systems, whereas rational maps in a single complex variable are nonlinear systems. So, but you could still imitate the methods and get answers here. The last thing on the slide I already mentioned before. and then I guess I can do justice to three people in the audience: Arvidsson and Lacker and Powers. Powers invented the an integer index for an endomorphism of B of H, and that integer index is the index on the top part here, and that is the endomorphism of that index, naturally isomorphic to a quotient of representations of O n, and the twiddle there is that two S I systems are equivalent if one is mapped to the other by an n by n unitary matrix, and it's a kind of it's an idea that has its analog in the other things we do here. And then the next thing is more directly connected to computing wavelet coefficients here, and it's also something about the Kunz algebra, and it's an extremely simple idea, because if you have to compute an infinite number of wavelet coefficients, there's something that has to go to infinity, and you would prefer that it's not all possible words in a finite alphabet. In this case here, the finite alphabet are the numbers 1, 2, up to n minus 1, because in the applications, the tradition for having the first one here being the so-called low pass, then we start our indexing of these S operators here by 0, and if we want O n here, then the last one's supposed to be n minus 1. And so it turns out that these words are the important words. You have the SIs other than the 0 1, and then you apply iterated powers of S 0 to it, and obviously you get an orthogonal family, and so you'd like that to be a representation of O n, but it isn't always. Here's what I'm looking at here. It isn't always. To be a representation of O infinity, you'd have to have this infinite sum being the identity operator, and you discover that that happens precisely when S 0 as an isometry is a shift. So if you think of a Wolf's characterization of shifts and Wolf's decomposition, you see that to get a representation of O infinity from a representation of O n with finite n, the first isometry must be a shift. And so you might wonder if that's true in all of these applications we have in mind. And that was one of the first things Ola Bradley and I looked into closely, and it turns out the answer is yes, but it's actually a very, very delicate issue, and there's always competition in finding proofs of that our proofs use ergodic theory, the same kind of ergodic theory that's used for these endomorphisms, and that's why I mentioned here. I'll give you the proof of the O infinity property for the case of n equal to 2, and here it is. It's very, very simple. You just add up the generators and the adjoints up to a finite number of steps, and you use the formula for S1 star, that's 1 minus the other generator here, and so you have the sum up from 0 to p minus 1, and the same sum from 1 minus p, so you get cancellation, only the first and the last with a minus sign. So for this one here to be convergent as p goes to infinity, this one has to go to 0, so you see that you get a representation of O infinity precisely when S 0 as an isometry is a shift. And so the other things that we will need is what the adjoints look like, and the adjoints involve the same kind of conditional expectation as I already mentioned before, and if n is equal to 2, the summation in this variable here is just the summation over the plus minus the square root of z, and as I said, if you're doing a substitution of a rational map other than just the quadratic polynomial here, in that case, you're, I because I just realized I can use this. In that case, you're just summing over all the pre-images of whatever rational map you're using in your substitution. Now, the other thing is I mentioned that you wanted the M systems to be an orthonormal basis in that Hilbert module. And so what you would like to do is see if it's enough to have one, and then if you can get the other. And that turns out to be yes, but it depends on the fact that here you only have two M functions. If you have more than two M functions, it's not always possible to construct a complementary M system here. But in this case, it's very easy, and this procedure again has been found by engineers, and so that's what that is. Here's what you need in general. Here's what you will need in general. The construction that you see there is precisely what makes this one a unitary matrix, and so you see that the particular representations here are characterized by this being a unitary matrix. So you might wonder, how in the world would you ever go about constructing these unitary matrices? If you write them in the multiplicative language, is this way, in the additive language, is this way, and if n is bigger than 2, then what it says is that if you have j being the row index and k the column index, then if you take the function here and if you modify it by a power of the nth root of unity here, psi n is the principal nth root of unity, you should get an n by n unitary matrix. So if you didn't have anything else to do, then it would seem like a completely hopeless thing to ever hope to be able to do. Fortunately, for these operators that we're doing here, what happens is that you can make use of a very important thing from representations of the Kunz relation. If you have two representations, S and T, of the Kunz relations, then you can form this matrix here. So there will obviously be an operator valued n by n matrix, and so that doesn't seem very interesting, but other than it's a nice unitary matrix. But if your S and your T operators, both coming from a Kunz relation, if they have this form here, in other substitution and multiplication, then the entries of this operator matrix here are multiplication operators, and it turns out that so if the entries are multiplication operators and this is unitary, that would mean that you get a map from the circle into the n by n unitary matrices. So that means you get an element in the loop group, and using simple formulas for the Kunz relations, you see that the points in the loop group act transitively on these kinds of representations. So if you have one, you get them all. And so that means all you have to do is understand what elements in the loop group that are required for generating the important M functions. So the name of the game is to find all the M functions. And it turns out that it's enough, since engineers are interested in finite computations, it's enough to generate polynomial loops, so that means functions from the circle into the unitary matrices here that are products of PZ plus P perpendicular, so finite products like this, where P is a projection in the n-dimensional complex Hilbert space. So take finite products of this, and that would be all loops here. Of course, they send z equals to 1 into the identity matrix, and if you don't like the identity matrix, you can just put a constant matrix here in front of it, and that is actually required, that's because of this low-pass condition we talked about. So that means that you have a bunch of representations of the Kunz algebra indexed by points in the loop group, and it turns out that that this is a transitive action, and since it's easy to write all the points in loop group down here, then you have an infinite group acting on the set of representations of the Kunz algebra. And it turns out, if you impose this low-pass condition that I talked about, that the M0 function is 1 at 0, that's low-pass. That's because the M0 function is the probability of passing a frequency in the frequency response language. And so z equal to 1 is the in the additive version that the frequency is 0, so 0 frequencies should pass in a low-pass filter, and the other frequencies should be killed off. That means that you cannot use monomials, because monomials are not 0. They have constant modulus. So the ones you need in wavelet theory do not have constant modulus, and that turns out to be an important thing. But the moral of the story is that you only need pick. In fact, you can, if you have a projection that's more than rank 1, then you can write it as sum of rank 1 that are orthogonal, and there would just be a product here. So you can just take rank 1 projections. That means you can take unit vectors in n-dimensional complex Hilbert space, and if you move finite configurations of unit vectors around, then you get all possible wavelet filters. And if you take one unit vector, two unit vectors, three unit vectors, you get more and more filters that accomplish more and more things. And here's a picture where we moved some unit vectors in a unit vector in R2, and so what one rotation of a vector is in this direction and the other is in this direction, and you see that you get wavelets for all of them, but some of them are better than others. So what the next question will be is, how would you ever go about finding the best ones? And for that, you need some spectral analysis of some of the operators that we're doing here. And when I talked to the engineers, they were wondering about what filters to use, et cetera, et cetera. And in the beginning, they're surprised that there was more than one. And so this is kind of a nice way of saying that there are as many solutions to these problems as there are configurations of unit vectors in the number of dimensions that's required for doing the filters. But I also mentioned that they're used for image processing, and the S operators, you need 4, and this picture will explain why you need 4 for that. If you look on my website, you see that my portrait has been slow motion run in a digital camera with a few filters here, and you would actually be able to see that it does different things as you change the filter around. And in terms of representations, you'd have the Kunz algebra O4 here, and you'd then have 4 M functions. The first one is M0, and M0 is the one that takes averages, and the other filters are designed to concentrate on the differences in the x direction, in the y direction, and in the diagonal direction. And as you iterate those, you just do this O infinity thing that I talked about a moment ago. And as you move towards the infinity, you keep subdividing. That's exactly what it is when you're doing these finite summations here. That's really subdividing making at each step subdividing dyadic subdivisions here, and so the numbers, the wavelet coefficients that come in at these places and the next places are the numbers that are stored in a digital camera, and they're very, very fast. If you had to do it with Fourier series, it would not stop it'd just be absolutely lousy for digitization of an exposure in a camera. Lo and behold, this way of keeping track of the S's is exactly what goes into how the camera is done. Then I mentioned that, by the way, these U operators are also, the U operators are also done by engineers, and they have names for them. They call them polyphase matrices, and you'd see in engineering books, you'd see them written this way here. They have their matrices in the output signal, and then followed by what's called time shifts here. And so you have a choice of doing the S's or doing a single element in your loop group as you analyze things. I want to skip something. Okay, so the next thing is how to use these to analyze problems and find the wavelet coefficients. And for that, I remind you again about the S's and the endomorphism. And if the S's do not have orthogonal ranges, we can do one of the favored dilations, Popescu or whichever name you assign to it, and get them orthogonal in a superspace. But the S's also come in at one important step here in these computations, because when I told you about wavelets, I said that you do it on the real line, but I've not been on the real line for the S operation. So the question is, what's the link between the analysis of L2 of the real line or L2 of RD and the space that the engineers work with? What is the connection? And so that's what I'd like to talk about in the next thing here. And it has to do with the wavelets having two generators. And there's one generator that picks out a subspace of L2 of RD. And so if you do translations of that by points in the integer lattice, and if you have more than one generator, and then you get a closed subspace, and the functions that you will be interested in here are called scaling functions. And the reason they're called scaling functions is that the subspace generated by translations of them should be invariant under the scaling operation. The scaling operation is the one that slows down the frequency. And so it turns out that you need to solve for these scaling functions. And once you have one, it's obviously that the one I showed you with the Haar wavelet does the job. And the solution to the problem with the M functions show that every M function gives you a scaling function. I'll show you in a moment. And so that means that if you map signals in this time space here into L2 functions by sending the k coordinate into the k translate here, then you find a way of using transformations on sequences in spaces of L2 functions in the real line. And that's really the way of encoding all the stuff that I said about the S transformations here. And so then in the real line, the S0 operator becomes a shift, because the scaling operator here in this picture just becomes the S0 operator in this picture, and it's an isometry. And so what you need is that it's a shift, so that the intersection of the ranges of that isometry is zero. And so that was the thing that I emphasized before, and that is indeed the case. And the other thing that I want to emphasize is that as you go down the chain of subspaces in the particular so-called resolution space, then each of the intermediate steps, the range of the S1 operator, but these S operators have very easy matrix forms. And so it simply just becomes a question of multiplying the matrix representation for the S operators, and you get your wavelet coefficients as that way. And no, no, I better. Right. So far so good. So now in the next slide, I'm going to compare two things. One is the most general unitary matrix for arbitrary n on one side, and the case where it's a simpler matrix on the other side. And the reason I want to compare them is that it has something to do with what we call n-isometries. This one here being unitary, we already decided that was easy to accomplish. All you have to do is use the fact that the loop group acts transitively on these representations. So if you have one, you can take the monomials, you get them all. And so that was easy, including all the ones with famous names such as Daubichi, etc. And the S operators have this form here. And if your endomorphism is other than substitution with a Z to N, then again, you have isometries with this form. You just have to be careful with the measure on these Julia sets here. But what if you don't want all that many functions here? What if you only want two columns of functions, one filter here and another one translated by half of a period in the dyadic case? Then you might wonder, what does it take to get a row isometry, in other words, to get dissatisfied? And what it takes is this. It only takes a function from a period interval into unit vectors in whatever your dimension is, with the property that it's translated by half a period is orthogonal to it. So it turns out that these two conditions are equivalent to these operators defining a row isometry in this sense here. As usual thing, a row and column depending on where you put your star. And so you might wonder if they give us wavelet bases by an analogous procedure. It turns out the answer is no. They would never be orthogonal functions unless you're in the square matrix case, which was this. So if you go to this case here, you're dropping one of the conditions in the Kunz relations, the orthogonality condition. So they could never be orthogonal wavelets, the wavelet functions you generate there. But to some people in approximation theory, that's good news because the orthogonality is sometimes considered a too strong requirement. Orthogonal wavelets cannot have symmetries, but these can have symmetries. So the next question is, what is it that you're losing by doing that? And what you're losing is is that instead of having an orthonormal basis, you only have what's called a frame of possible basis, and that is that you don't have orthogonality, but you have the condition which corresponds, which is a consequence of what you would have if they were an orthonormal basis. And so since one of the corollaries of an orthonormal basis is in our analysis book is called Parseval's identity, and often the kind of wavelet functions which give the Parseval identity without being an orthonormal basis are called Parseval wavelets, and that's what they are. And again, we can do it with other substitutions here. And again, the unitary loop groups are acting transitively on it, and we get all the solutions with this procedure here. And then the next thing that I had on the agenda was talking about the theorem of limits here. And so if you study this problem here, again, back to the simplest case and the simplest wavelet generator. By the way, let me just write down the wavelet equation here. So these are supposed to span a subspace of L2 of the real line. So if you put some numbers in front of it and take the sum of this, that should give you the scaled wavelet function. So it should give you phi at x divided by 2. And so that that's called the scaling identity. And so you can play around with numbers here and L2 functions phi, and you will discover that the numbers that solve this equation are precisely the coefficients in this M analysis that we're doing. So this says that the scaling operator is mapping phi into the space spanned by its translation. And so if you iterate that, you get a chain here, because you can scale by all powers of 2. And so you get a scale of increasing spaces by using U or U star. And so the spaces are often called multi-resolutions. And to get an orthonormal basis, you must have two things: that the union of them is dense in whatever your Hilbert space is, in this case L2 of the real line, and the intersection should be zero. And so one of the things that Ola and I did, we analyzed that for a general class of scaling problems like this, and we showed that the restriction of the scaling operator, whether it's this one or the one coming from matrices or the one coming from complex iteration theory, that the restriction of the scaling operator as an isometry on the subspace of L2 of the real line, generated by the scaling function here, the intersection is zero. And so that was what we did. And let me put it on here. And I'll summarize a couple of features in this reasoning here. So I already mentioned that the scaling operator is an operator on L2 of the real line. There it is. But it's equivalent to the S0 operator on this space. And again, you can pick and choose whether you want functions in the frequency variable or whether you want your little L2 space. There it is in the frequency variable, and there are the conditions for the M function, and there finally is the condition for the scaling equation. And there I've been careful putting in the right normalization here, and I've also reminded you of the relations. And now you can see that if you Fourier transform this one here, you get an infinite product formula for phi hat. And once you have that, you get the other functions using the other MI functions. And so the question is, if the intersection of all of these, as you continue the scaling identity here, if the intersection is zero, so we analyze a candidate for a function in the intersection, and we use that conditional expectation I showed you before, and in the limit we get that using the ergodic theorem, the pointwise ergodic theorem, we get in the because anyway we get that the either the modulus of squared of this must be constant almost everywhere, or the modulus squared of the M0 function, but they're also related by a co-cycle identity which comes from the scaling equation here. So if one is a constant almost everywhere, so must the other one be. But since f is a L2 function in the real line, if the modulus is constant, it must be zero, otherwise it couldn't be an L2. So that's the essence of the proof of why you get a multi-resolution for all of these problems. If you didn't, then S0 wouldn't be a shift, but people wouldn't really care about that outside mathematics. But what that would mean is that you have a part of your signal space which is not covered by this procedure here, and that would have been a disaster. The next question is. Some of the other things come in into whether when you move to the L2 space of the real line, whether you get orthonormal bases or not. And the thing that I wanted to say about, here it is. So there's some cases where you sort of expect that you would get an orthonormal basis by this procedure here, but you do not. And the simplest case is a version of the Haar wavelet, but modified a little bit. Instead of taking an interval from 0 to 1, you can take an interval from 0 to 3, and then making a third high. And for the other one, you can do this. And it turns out that the wavelet coming from this satisfies all the conditions we talked about, except one. And so this one here would only be what we call a tight frame or passable basis. And so the question is, if you look at an M0 function and its brother, the M1 function, you need to know if the wavelet you get is orthogonal or if it's only this weaker property here. And there are some spectral theoretic ways of doing that, which go under the name path measures and ergodic limits, and use a so-called transfer operator. And but the engineers, in fact, had an idea already in the early days for what went wrong for the wavelets like this one here that are not orthonormal bases. And what it is that it's this function, M0 square, which is really a probability measure on the signals that are processed. And it's supposed to be low pass, and so it's only supposed to pass frequencies 0. So if we go around like this from minus a half to a half, and then 0 is in the middle by this normalization here, and so a half is here, that would be the high frequency. And this one here is supposed to be 1 because it's a measure of the how much is passed at 0 frequency, so at frequency equal to 0. And if you calculate M0 for these other ones, you discover that there are some frequencies here and here that also satisfy this. And so the processing of this, the frequency bands, is not orthogonal, and so the wavelet is not orthogonal, and so the filter is from the point of view of engineers, is clearly a bad filter, but the question of counting cycles in a compact space under a transformation is actually very, very productive for all the other much more general problems we talked about with the iteration of an endomorphism of a compact space. And so what you have to pay attention to in all of these other problems is the points in the compact space where the weight function is equal to 1. So the weight function attains a maximum at some point, and if it attains a maximum at a finite set of points, that gives a completely different ergodic theory of the limits that you work with. And so that's the subject of the next talk here, but maybe I'll just give a brief introduction to it. So so this is much more general than the endomorphisms that you need for wavelets. You can talk about it for an endomorphism of a compact Hausdorff space that's onto the number of points in the pre-image. If it's onto, there should always be something in the pre-image, and it'd be finite, so it's a local homeomorphism. And so you have a weight function. Normally, we put the counting point into the definition of the weight function W here, and so the weight function W has this probabilistic interpretation, and it's just saying that if sigma is the endomorphism, then the the weight function should give you a probability distribution on all the pre-images. And that's exactly what this one does over there in the simplest case. And so the question is to analyze how the processing of these signals here is done in this more general setting here. And for that, I guess I have time to just give you a brief preview of some of that. And so the definitions is that a cycle in this case here is a finite set of points where you move by the endomorphism from one to the next and the last one goes back to the first. And a W cycle is a cycle where the weight function attains its maximum value. And and so that was what happened to these filters here. They have different Godic theoretic properties. And then the other actor in this program here is called a solenoid, and it's just a covering space for X, which turn so that the endomorphism turns into an automorphism on the solenoid, and there's a definition of it. And then the other things that we need is this measure that I already mentioned, the measure that distributes equally on the pre-images, and then the transfer operator is so the transfer operator RWF of X is the summation WY F of Y, summation over all the pre-images. And then turns out that for each transfer operator like that, there's a measure which is invariant under that operator. Such measures lift to measures in the solenoid in the sense that you get the initial measure on X on the first coordinate, and the weight function becomes the rather negative derivative of the shifted measure on the solenoid, and you get one more thing's coming into the game. You get the back images under the endomorphism, and here's a theorem about these cycles here. If the backward images of every point is dense, which is true for the example with the Julia sets, if the weight function is continuous, if it has at most a finite number of zeros, then the measure for this transfer operator here has the following dichotomy: either it has full support or else it is an atomic measure and it's supported on these funny W cycles, these diffuse cycles where the signal escapes through when it shouldn't. And let's see, how many minutes? Oh, okay. So I can mention this thing here in the context of the wavelets here. So here's the endomorphism R and the solenoid and applications to the wavelet equation. There's a scaling identity for the wavelet equation, and we Fourier transform it so that the Fourier transform of the scaling identity becomes a cocycle relation, since the Fourier series in N-variable is a function on the detours, the frequency response function becomes a function on the detours. The next question is then what happens when we iterate that? When we divide by powers of the scaling matrix, and so we get I need striptease method here. So by the way, this is the same scaling identity closely related to the one Ken Davidson mentioned. Here you get that the substitution operator, but there it's an endomorphism, and so you get an increasing family of spaces on the torus. And in this application here, the unitary operator looks like this, and it's and its version in the extended space is then a version on the L2 space with respect to the extended measure. And so you extend from the symbol space to this space here. And the case of the wavelets is really really that the real line, or RD, sits in the solenoid in the way that it always happens. The RD is always embedded in the solenoid built on the detours, so what happens is, for wavelet theory, the wavelets live on RD, but in general the wavelets might be functions on a big solenoid, and so it's of interest to decide when your extended Hilbert space is a Hilbert space of nice functions or not. And and that question is decided by the support property of the measure mu hat that I talked about a moment ago. The question of the extended space really goes back then to the question of extending an isometry to become a unitary operator, the solution becomes this problem here. And in general, in wavelet theory here, then you have to have matrix functions if you have more generators than one. And so you have that the weights, instead of becoming functions into the scalars, become matrix functions. And so your transfer operators become matrix identities like this, and your solutions become covariance relations on the Hilbert space you get by dilating your initial isometry here. And so again, you have to keep track of the multiplicities as they change in these extended spaces. So what you can do is you can calculate the multiplicity of the representation of the abelian algebra on these resolution subspaces here. And one of the very, very important facts, the multiplicity function was found by Larry Backett and Kathy Merrill. And if you keep track of the multiplicity function on the resolution space and the next space here, then this is the equation that it must satisfy. And so the question is kind of going the other way. If for every matrix system with a multiplicity function satisfying this multiplicity relation, if you can then find a wavelet that solves that problem, and the answer is yes, if you are careful with the definition of your low-pass property for the matrix filter functions. So again, it goes through this procedure here. In principle, you're looking at a solenoid, but it turns out that the solutions to the wavelet problems are supported on the dense subset of the solenoid made up by RD. And so the solutions to the wavelet problem in this sense here is really the solution to a bunch of co-cycle identities. So maybe I'll stop with that. So again, your chain of identities goes like this, with the isometry and its unitary dilation, and the solution to the wavelet problems is up in this line here, and the solution to the other problem is down in this line. and so maybe I'll just stop with that.